Hi, this is Jamie Ruby, and welcome to Fandom Access for Thursday, July 5th. Tonight is our special 12 Monkey episode with special guest Todd Stashwick, who plays Deacon. I think Todd is running a little late, and for some reason I'm hearing myself speak through my computer. Hold on a second. I might have to just mute this here a second so I don't. Okay, so anyway, I believe Todd's running a little late. I know he was getting back from the airport, so let me bring it. Hold on 1 second. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, hi. Sorry. I wasn't sure if you're my co-host or not. I could not remember her phone number.
No, this is Todd Stashwick.
Thank you for calling. Yeah, well, good. I'm glad. Thank you for calling. I wasn't sure if you were here or not. I sent you a message, so just ignore that. Well, we can start. Like I was starting to say, my co-host should be showing up soon. She's running a little late as well.
Okay.
But we can go ahead and get started. And if anybody wants to call in and ask questions, 914-338-0314. Unfortunately, the chat on Blog Talk Radio does not seem to work anymore, so you have to dial in. And sometimes
okay.
we get callers and sometimes we don't. But hopefully we will. But no spoilers.
Okay.
So if anybody wants to listen, we're not going to spoil anything. All right. So I guess while I'm waiting, I might as well ask you some things, and probably some of this we'll have talked about earlier, but to give people some, you know, good things to listen to. So some of them will repeat. But I was going to ask, now that the show's over, it's been obviously a while since you've been there, but did you get to take anything from the 12 Monkey set?
I did. I got to keep Deacon's his signature coat with the hat slash marks on the sleeve. I got to keep some Hyena Burger shirts, some pants, some I got the Word of the Witness, and
oh, that's cool.
I got, even though I'm not on it, I got to keep, Terry gave me a bunch of Jennifer's sketches and one
cool.
she did of Deacon. And then I got to keep a West 7 quarantine zone flag that was sort of half burned up. I'm still gunning for the bell. I want one of the bells. And Terry has promised me that I would also get my knife.
Cool. That's a good prop. You got a lot of things then.
Yeah, you know, like it's I couldn't live without. Oh, then I also got all of Deacon's like jewelry, his like rings and his necklace and his bracelets and all that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's really good. They gave you so much. I think sometimes it depends on the show, but that's cool.
Yeah.
So are you going to be on social media live tomorrow night?
Right now, I don't know because I'm currently filming Kim Possible up in Vancouver. And so I don't know what time I will be done working to be able to jump on and enjoy with the good people.
Well, I'm sure a lot of the cast, though, will be live tweeting for if other people want to, even if they miss you. Hopefully you'll show up after. All right. Well, so what I was going to say is kind of I'm trying to think of the best way to word this, but thinking about the show, like if it was, you know, later on, I guess in the future, what do you kind of want people to take away from this show? Have you thought about that? I don't know.
What, like as a whole?
Yeah, just kind of, I don't know, what do you expect people to kind of, I don't know, get from it, think about it, you know, as a whole?
You know, I can never, entertainment is so subjective that you never know. I just want people to be entertained. And what I would love is for the life of this show to continue and grow even though we're done making it. I would love for it to, you know, become that show that people are like, wow, this thing is amazing, when they can watch all four seasons on one streaming service or get it off of iTunes or by the, you know, by the DVDs. I'm actually not plugging. I'm just realizing. But when you can, I think I'll be fascinated to see people's reaction when they absorb the entire series as a whole. But more than anything else, I just want them to be entertained. And that means all forms of entertainment, whether they're frightened, they find it funny, they find it thought-provoking, that it angers them, like all of the emotions that good television can produce. We really wanted to make a great piece of entertainment.
Right. I know, obviously it's going to, I guess, take a while because there's four seasons, but I keep thinking that I really want to go back and do a rewatch. I had wanted to before the finale, but I had run out of time. Hold on. I believe this is my co-host, Karen. Let me bring her in. Hello, Karen.
Oh, great.
Hi. How are you guys? Nice to be here.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
It's Todd. This is Todd from 12 Monkeys. I know you know he's coming, was coming.
And is this live right now?
Yes, this is live. Like I said, sometimes we get call-ins, sometimes we don't. It seems to kind of be random, and I know it's kind of late for a lot of people, at least who are on the East
Coast.
Yeah, because it's 11:30 here. Why don't I, Karen, why don't you go ahead and ask a question while we're waiting and seeing if anybody calls, and we'll kind of take turns.
Sure. Thanks so much for
here.
Sure. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's great to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, so I have not seen the finale. I've caught up through what's already aired on television, and we just lost Deacon, sadly. He lost his head. I wanted to ask you about when you knew that Deacon was going to die and what type of death he would have. Did you know from early in the season we don't know what his eventual fate is. The viewers don't. This is a time travel show, and several people have died and then traveled in time. So, but as of now, we've lost him. And I wondered when you knew what did you think? Personally, I thought he had a great death. And I wondered what you, as the actor, thought about it.
I knew pretty much going into season four what his fate would be, and I think I learned how his fate would be delivered around the same time. I think what I found most profound about it is the entire arc of this character, who was very much, I'm not saying he was, he was a protector from the beginning, because he certainly protected the West Seven, but it was a much more selfish, hey, if I can just keep my 200 people fed, I don't care what happens, the rest of the world can go to hell, type thing, to, really, changing his worldview and changing his and actually letting people in and actually doing things not out of pure survival but out of sacrifice of himself, an altruistic side for others, and I think that's the most profound thing about his death. The way he went out was pretty badass.
To follow on real quickly, as I sort of digested what happened, I wondered. So in that scene there in the mini in 1491, I think it is. Deacon runs his mouth a little bit, as he often does, and Olivia decides that he's going to die first. Jamie and I talked a little bit earlier this week about, like, was Deacon buying time? So that the others would be saved. And I kind of wondered, like, so what was his sacrifice? I mean, was Deacon sacrificing himself for the team? Did he sacrifice himself, do you think, for Cole? Did he really do it for Cassie? Help save Cole because of Cassie, or save Cole because of the right thing? Like, do you know what was going on there, or did you have to create that motivation for yourself as you played it?
Well, You know, it's interesting because if you look at the conversation that he has with Cole, and all of the things leading up to that moment, especially in that episode, he really comes to learn that Cole is kind of, you know, the chosen one, right? And mm-hmm. so I think Deacon knows that on whatever level he can to keep Cole safe in that moment, ultimately plays itself out to hopefully, you know, they all have faith that Cole is the key to saving the world, right? Saving time. And so with that knowledge, knowing that Olivia had, you know, chosen Cole to go first to lose his head, Deacon realized that whatever he can do in that moment to buy time, so that Cole can hopefully survive, is important. Because if Cole is the chosen one and he's the one who's going to bring this all home, if Cole, the longer Cole lives, the better we all have a chance of saving the world.
Right.
So Todd, I know. Sorry, Gofka.
No, go ahead.
I know,
Jamie,
we were talking
please.
Before. You were telling me how this was like the last scene you filmed, and you guys were in Prague. And can you kind of just talk a bit about that for everybody?
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of oddly, you know, the way, because you often shoot out of sequence. I mean, we had to shoot all the stuff in the temporal facility. We had to shoot all that stuff out in Toronto, and then we had to block shoot a bunch of stuff once we got to Prague. And so it just so worked out that film my death as the last thing that I shot on the entire series. And so it was quite special, because the words that were written for Deacon very much echoed what was going on in my heart, because I was having to look at my cast members who I'd been through thick and thin with for the last four seasons, and I had to literally sit and face them because they were sitting there right in front of me as the cameras were pointed at me, and I had to look at them and say goodbye. I had to say I'd do it all again for them, this I know. And it wasn't a hard scene to play the reality of the emotion, because I was, as Deacon was saying goodbye to these characters, Todd was saying goodbye to these actors. This is the last thing that I would be shooting with these people. So it was quite poetic.
And is that unusual? I'm sorry, have you died before on television?
Have you died many times? I die all the time, but what's unusual for me is I'd done 11 episodes of the Originals, and I had done, you know, a season and a half of The Riches, but this show, I was there from season one all the way through season four, and the relationships that were forged and the friendships that were forged and the creative relationships that were forged. Ironically, today, flying up for Vancouver, I was in the airport, and I go into the little lounge there, and I hear across the room, Todd! And I turn around, and Kirk Acevedo is also on my flight. And even weirder, we literally were sat next to each other. So I just spent the entire day with Kirk, reminiscing and stuff. And so it was, you know, when you spend that much time with somebody, with these people, often at ridiculous hours in very strange, extenuating circumstances, and you travel across the planet to spend time in other countries with them, and you run the crucible that is Comic-Con with these people, you dig in deep, you know. You can't help but leave a bit of yourself with each other. and vice versa.
Talk about a guy who dies all the time, Kirk, right, Jamie? Every show
we watch,
Kirk gets killed.
That's true.
Yeah, but you know, when you play bad guys a lot, you often end up with a. I was working with Joe Mantegna on Criminal Minds, and we were discussing the fact that, you know, he's often played villains. He goes, "Yeah, you and I have that in common. We're both Chicago boys who wind up with a lot of lead in us because we end up getting shot at or killed or." It's either wind up dead or in handcuffs often in my career.
I was going to say, one of the roles, and this was like one episode a long time ago, and I don't know why it's one thing that stands out to me. And Karen, I don't know if you remember, but the one role I always remember you from is Middleman. And I don't
know
why.
Oh, my goodness.
But that was so long ago.
That was a
We had actually
fun,
done a podcast on that back then. Yeah.
And speaking of,
I
did one episode, and I walked out of that show with still maintaining a friendship with Javi and with Natalie Morales. Like, Natalie and I, we text each other at least once a month, and she comes over to our house for parties. Like, I've maintained friendships with these people. It's a very strange profession I'm in, but yeah, that was a heck of a show.
Didn't live long enough, unfortunately.
I know.
Do you have another question, Karen?
I do. One of the things that, Todd, that I found to be like a real delight, particularly in this season, is the relationship between Deacon and Jennifer. And particularly in these last few episodes, he walks into the room and she sort of lights up and is always so happy to see him. And we have that moving scene with the knife and everything. And that's despite the fact that Deacon killed Jennifer once.
Yes.
He killed a version of Jennifer. And I wondered, I'm interested in that relationship, what it's like to play, where it evolved from. I know in your recent interview with Jamie, you talked about the way the writers have been able to use sort of all of you actors. I just wonder how much of that stems from your own personal chemistry with Emily, which is evident on the screen. Or if that was on the page or what that's about. I love it.
I think it stemmed from probably initially because in season one, I had zero dealings with Jennifer. And so there's a passing comment where I'm putting the hallucinogenic powder into him. And I said, you know, this is something that I got from the daughters. And so it's alluded to that he's had connection with old Jennifer. But I met Emily at the, it was kind of cool. I met Emily at the premiere party in LA after I had shot all my episodes from season one. I was introduced to Emily at the premiere party and that was also the day that I found out that my deal had closed to come on as a series regular for season two. So it was a really special party. And so that was the day that I met her. And I think Terry and the writers credit, I think what they saw both in Emily's character, in Jennifer and Deacon, was they're both outsiders. And they're both often judged very quickly. Deacon is dismissed as just a sociopath and a smartass, and Jennifer is dismissed as crazy. And I think because these characters sort of lived on the fringe of the main cast, there was a natural. It made sense to bring them together because they often were, and I've said this before, they often were the canary in the coal mine. They often were seeing things that other people were blind to. In fact, there was a moment in the end of season two where Deacon goes, crazy's making sense here. And he saw in Jennifer things that other people were kind of dismissing already. And I think for Jennifer and old Jennifer, she knew Deacon and they were survivors and they had spent time in each other's worlds. So on the page, there was definitely a built-in connection between actors. I just delight in Emily, and I think, and she has come out to see me do improv, and she loves to play. You know, she's a silly gal. There's so much of Emily and Jennifer, and there's so much of Todd and Deacon that, yeah, of course, that sort of silliness between these characters. Plus, she drops all the movie references, and Deacon drops a lot of movie references, and so they just sort of tied these characters together in the margins, and I thought it was a beautiful thing. And then Emily and I just leaned into it.
I still ship the two of them. I know they're friends, but I don't know. I sometimes see it. I think it would be fun. Like, I'd love to see a spinoff with you two. Friendship, whatever. But I think they'd be fun to watch.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing because she is, her character is just, she's just popcorn popping. And Deacon is just such a, he's a glass of bourbon. I mean, he's just kind of slow and cool. He can be a hothead, but he sort of comes in under the radar, and she is always at an 11. And so it is a really nice dynamic between the two that it would be interesting to see where else and what else they could do down the road. I have no idea what that show would be. It would be fun to actually just take the actors and put us in another show just to keep playing in that chemistry. But I've always thought,
yeah,
I always thought Deacon and Jennifer's chemistry is much more brother and sisterly.
Yeah, there's a little bit of maybe something protective there in Deacon.
Very much. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I guess that's part of his character in general. He's protected.
Yeah.
I mean, even as much as you might think he was mean to Cole and Ramsey early on, he was protecting them and was so happy when they evolved, those two guys, sort of.
Exactly. I mean, he's a survivor, and he kept, you know, it's funny because we often talked about this. Like, DK was the one who was always painted as the monster. But he kept 200 people alive in this harsh environment. And did he slaughter the West 7? Sure, but Jones slaughtered all of Spearhead. So it's like, who's the monster? Like, is it because I do it with a smile on my face and I don't walk around all broody and moody about it? We still went after what we wanted and killed people to get it, but somehow Deacon is the one who has the scarlet letter of a sociopath on him.
I guess he didn't have all that science talk to justify what he'd done and you know, didn't articulate the way somebody like Jones does.
No, but I also wasn't trying to save the world. I was trying to just, in this crappy world, I was trying to keep 200 people alive.
He's the Rick Grimes.
Yeah, in a way, it's funny because he's a Rick in Negan's clothing, right?
Right. Yeah, literally, almost with the bomber jacket and the scarf,
which I had first. Thank you very much.
You did.
Deacon was around 2 years before Negan.
Very true. I was going to say, and I think we talked about this, I don't know, a year ago or something. I vaguely remember talking about this with you. But do you think that, I think Deacon, kind of the apocalypse has been good for him. I mean, obviously seems to have made him a better person. But just in general, I mean, he seems to, I don't know, thrive in that kind of environment, I guess.
Well, I think because of, you know, and we learned, you know, we learned in season 3 how he was raised. I think he was cursed with a skill set that was exploited in the apocalypse. I mean, I think had there been no apocalypse, he would have just probably, you know, been had a bad temper and, you know, probably wouldn't have been the best father, you know, unless he, you know, found a way to finally work through all the pain that was inflicted on him as a child. But it was because of that, because his father said, look, I was given scars, so that's all I had to give you. That, in many ways, paired him to be a leader who could shut down his emotions and do the ugly things that it took to survive.
And just jumping off that, I just want to say I was thinking about it. I think your scene from season 3 they came together, playing yourself and your father. That's still like one of my favorite scenes, I think, of yours, because it's really cool how that kind of played out.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was a special thing that they wrote for me. Very special. It's a meal.
So do you have
let your hand do that. It's such a gift.
Do you have any conventions or appearances or anything coming up? I know the show's over, but hopefully still.
Currently,
still
no.
Going to places.
I won't be making it. Yeah, I won't be making it to San Diego this year because I'm still up in Vancouver doing Kim Possible. So I won't be coming back from that until the weekend of Comic-Con. So I don't think there's enough time to turn around and go to San Diego. So as of right now, I have nothing planned. I have a script to finish, and I have looking forward to whatever the next job would be after Kim Possible. But no, I do really enjoy going to conventions because I like sneaking around and buying collectibles. And I also love, I'm such a fan of genre that I really appreciate and understand the fans of our show and the other shows that I've been fortunate to be a part of. I get where they're coming from because I too am a fan of sci-fi and fantasy. So yeah, I'm always open if I'm not working. If there's a con that wants to bring me, I'm happy to go. The cons I bring my family to are always just the local ones, the ones that I can drive to, like WonderCon or Long Beach Comic-Con. And then we also go to the Halloween ones like Monsterpalooza and Scare LA. I really get a kick out of that stuff. There might be some cons that we do. I honestly don't know what they have planned for Kim Possible. That will roll out when it rolls out. But yeah, I don't have anything right now. So my dance card is free.
I was going to ask, you said finishing a script. Do you mean finish filming or are you writing something? I wasn't sure the way you said that.
I am currently co-writing Suicide Squad 2.
Shut up,
wow,
really?
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's like a big thing.
It's a big thing, yeah. I'm working with Gavin O'Connor, who's directing it, and he and I had worked on a couple projects together. I was an actor, and he knew I was a writer, and he also knew that I was a big genre comic book guy, because that's the kind of the stuff that I write. And he invited me to join him and the screenwriter David Barkatz, and we are writing Suicide Squad 2.
Cool.
Oh, so that, I mean,
when
that
comes
like
out, you'll have to
full time job.
Yeah.
I mean, you throw that up. You're like, oh, I'm writing something. I have nothing going on. But
well, no, I don't have. I don't
kind
have
of a
I,
big
I don't have
thing.
Any, I was answering the question of do I have any cons coming up?
Yeah.
But is the script all consuming? Yeah, it's a big task. So meaning that is my job when I'm. You know, I'm working on that while I'm working on Kim Possible. And then when all of those things finish, I don't know exactly what the future holds. And the fun thing is for me, it's like if you had asked me, because I've been working on Suicide Squad 2 for a while, if you'd asked me the month before I got to do that, I wouldn't have seen that coming. If you asked me the month before I started 12 Monkeys back in 2014, I wouldn't have seen that coming or even Kim Possible. So when somebody goes, well, what do you want to do next? I'm like, well, I want to be as delighted and surprised as I have been fortunate enough to be up to this point. So what September looks like, I don't know. October, I don't know. I'm always excited to find out.
Cool. I wanted to ask you, before I forget, you know, obviously 12 Monkeys is very, very complex. A lot of things going on, and I know that you guys get some of the stuff early, but I was just curious, throughout the seasons, did you ever have any – whoop, my alarm's going off. Sorry about that. My alarm's always going off. Did you, like, have any of your own kind of theories of things throughout the show? that turned out, well, either turned out to be true or turned out to be crazy, who knows? But did you kind of like try to think of things, or did you not really think about it that way?
It's funny because Terry and the writer, their process was very fluid. They were always working on things, and then they would, you know, I would get a call or text, and he would try out an idea, and like as they're fleshing out and breaking stuff, and definitely like in our hiatus between seasons, he would say, "Here's what we're thinking for season three." So I never tried to theorize, because it's a moving target at the time. Like when they're in the writing process, I mean, there are things that he definitely knew he was going to have take place by the series finale, but along the road there were things that would, you know, zig and zag and little specifics. Oh, I think I want you and Jennifer to have this you know, in the 80s. We're pairing you and Jennifer up for the art gallery heist. And so he would try out ideas on me, not try them out, but just sort of. He would just sort of say, he would always kind of keep me in the loop as to what they were thinking. And then ask if I had any thoughts and everything. And he was always super collaborative with that. But I never theorized, because A, it could change. B, you know, I was always to hear what they were coming up with.
Well, Karen, do you have any more questions? I've been asking quite a few.
No, I don't know how much time we have here with Todd. If you're getting ready to,
I'm just chilling in my hotel room here in Vancouver. So I'm here. If you have any more questions.
Okay, good. So you have a few more minutes. I'm actually interested in something that you mentioned to us a few minutes ago, that you do improv.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned in your interview with Jamie that I think is not on the website yet, but you made a mention of having done a lot of comedy. We've seen you in this very dramatic role. Are you a comedian? Are you a dramatic actor? Do you do both? I'm interested in, I personally find improv to be probably one of the, something I would never try, something that's pretty scary and difficult. It's a really difficult, you know, it's so much harder than it looks, I think, right? And I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about that part of your career.
Well, this despite my post-apocalyptic demeanor, my roots are Second City, Chicago. I spent almost 6 years in Chicago doing improv, Improv Olympic, and then I performed with Second City for years, and then I was up for Saturday Night 1995, I think, and then I had an improv group I was in New York. So it is those roots run very, very deep, and they deeply inform so much of my process and so much of my writing, and I continue to perform every Halloween with a group called The Doubtful Guests that we've taken to Austin, we've taken to various festivals, and we put it up in LA. It's just kind of a Halloween type show. So as comedy goes, that's what I grew up wanting to be, Bill Murray, and keen-eyed viewers will spot many Bill Murray-isms in Deacon, to the point where I think at one point I said, holy shit, it's Gozer. And that was an improvised line. Like there's a lot of Chicago Second City improv in my bones. So yeah, I'm a big comedy guy. Half my resume is Dan and Greg and Will and Grace and half hour sitcoms. I did Malcolm in the Middle. And then the other half is me being puffed or shot. it's a big part of who I am as a performer, and it informs so much of how I approach a script, how I approach a scene, how I approach my relationship with the other actors. Improv is a big thing for me. So, you know, somebody, a friend of mine, a teacher, he once said, acting is just improvising, but you happen to be saying what the writer wrote. Because improv is listening, is reacting. You and I right now in this conversation, we are improvising. You say something that inspires me to say something. I respond to that. I add something to it, and that triggers something in you, and you respond to that. It's all improvisation. Now, there are ways to hone that and practice it like you would. You know, it's often like basketball where you go, well, in practice, you know, you're practicing a lot of different moves when you're, you know, learning the game of basketball. But when the whistle blows, the ball goes anywhere, and then you just have to be wide awake and keep your eye on the ball and be ready for it when it comes your way. And then so much of that in improvisation that you're sort of at the edge of your seat with your ears wide open. But the fun part for me is also I was a theater kid, and I was a theater kid in junior high school, at high school, and I have my degree in theater, so I did so much stage comedy, which is breaking down the math of the line and breaking down where the joke lands and how the shape of the joke is. So that's been a huge part of my life too. And the performance job, like I was actually joking with Kirk Acevedo, because the kind of work on Kim Possible is much broader and sillier at times, even though it's grounded and you want the character to be emotionally believable. He's a living, breathing version of a cartoon character. So it's going to be for the Disney Channel. It's like I say to Kirk, I'm like going from where we whisper 90% of our lives on 12 Monkeys, because you know, your body mic, the camera's right up your nose, and everybody talks like this. To being able to, you know, play to the balcony and do all those fast, quick turns that you do when you're doing comedy. It's kind of fun to get out of the temporal facility and the fog and chew up a little scenery.
Cool. Now, you said that you like science fiction and genre television. What do you like to watch when you're not acting, when you have time? I don't know how much time you have. But
We sit down, my daughter and my wife and I, we sit and we watch Doctor Who. I'm still making my way through Walking Dead. We're still making our way through Legion. We love Black Mirror, and on the comedy side, we love Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That was one of our favorite shows. We watch a lot of genre television, so mostly genre television when I'm watching. Well, I can't sit down and watch TV. I just watched. I'm going through the Hobbit films with my daughter right now.
Those are good.
Because I read her the book as a bedtime story a few years back, and now we're sitting down where she's old enough that she can watch the film, because it feels a little rougher than the book, but now she's old enough to handle it.
Well, you watch everything that we and our listeners on this podcast watch. you should have a podcast.
I'm a Star Wars kid. You know, I was 8 years old in 1977, so I was indoctrinated from the word go. I had Planet of the Apes action figures and Star Trek action figures, and I had, I had my Battlestar Galactica toys from the original series, and not much has changed. I just the fact I have a collectible just changed, you know, the Living Time Show collectible guy, and I also like to buy original movie posters, and
oh yeah, you're speaking my language. I turned 9 in the summer of 77, and
yep.
I also remember standing in line to see Star Wars for the third time.
Yeah,
and
I was the target audience for Ready Player One.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Indeed,
so
you
were.
Oh yeah, that was so fun.
I was a D&D playing Atari kid, and so yeah. That is right in my strike zone, and it's those films: Ghostbusters, Back to the Future, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Those were all the films that I mean, my play was made up very much of pretending to be Han Solo as a boy. Ghostbusters, like, these were the things that informed how I played, and these were the scenes of the character in the first place. So they don't go away. And I'm fortunate that I get to, you know, make that stuff for other kids watching.
You know, so now I have a question here that's interesting. So we, on this podcast, we have three co-hosts and we sort of span a generation in our experiences. And you're making me, what you're talking about is making me think about how you as an actor, you know, how does that grounding in a lot of like, a lot of the pop culture that the genre culture you just mentioned really influences things that the, maybe to a lesser extent, 12 Monkeys, but to a great extent, other genre things that are on television right now. And how does that yes. background, like, maybe ground you as an actor, those influences ground you performing genre in a different way than maybe a younger actor who came to those like, seminal pieces of culture in a different way at a different time?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for any other actor. I can only speak from my experience. But like I said, I understood why these stories were told, and I understood how they were told. And there's a different kind of, you know, there's a different sensibility to them. And there's so much heart films that we came up with. And as evil as Deacon always seemed, I always try to put a lot of heart in my characters. Like, my goal is to, hopefully at some point, if I'm, you know, on a show for long enough, maybe even play the bad guy, to give a glimpse at what motivates these characters, and maybe tug at the heartstrings with them, because you see the person behind the monster. You know, I mean, having played Dracula, and that was such a gift to do on Supernatural, because they literally tore the mask off at one point. Not literally tore the mask off, but he dropped the facade and you saw the scared, hurt man underneath it. And I think there's so much of that that comes from, like, the bravado of Harrison Ford and yet the fragility of Indiana Jones. I mean, he would get beat up and Han Solo would get jealous and wounded. And those little flashes of humanity and otherwise what one would see as a two-dimensional hero, that's why we still talk about Han Solo. That's why we still talk about Indiana Jones and Bill Murray. Like, people were very, very human. And even though they were larger than life and iconographic, connecting to the humanity of these people is what makes them stand the test of time.
So moving forward in pop culture time, I have to ask, because you made me wonder, who's your favorite doctor?
Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, really? Cool. That's one you
yeah.
don't hear a lot. That's surprising.
Well,
not surprising, but I mean,
my first,
you don't hear a lot.
He was my first.
Have you seen the original series at all?
You came up with it. I always remember it being on PBS when I was a boy. And of course, there was, you know, I think I slid right into the Tom Baker era. So whenever somebody would say Doctor Who, his big eyes and crazy hair is what immediately came to mind. And then when they rebooted, I went to London. I was on a trip, and my friend said, "You need to watch this new series, this reboot of Doctor Who." And so I bought the DVDs from London and brought them home. And so Eccleston was my foray into Doctor Who, as was for many people. What I loved about what he did is he would balance this sort of just sweet goofball with this very dark, wounded soul. And when he would go dark and he would chastise Rose and call her a stupid human, and there was something really fascinating how he would then click out of it. And he has a couple of my two favorite lines from the entire series, all the way through Capaldi, which is, and they're both in the same episode, the dances, when he says, "Oh, give me a like today." And then everybody lives. And it's such a, and he's just so filled with joy and hope. And from a man who witnessed, you know, memoirs, and you could see the darkness and knowing what he saw, which is why he embraced life and humanity so much, because he knows how bad it is. And I think Eccleston captured that quality more than any of the other subsequent doctors.
Yeah. All right, cool. Karen, I was going to ask you, is he breaking up to you? Because I'm, like, losing a little bit of what you're saying in and out. I don't know if it's just my line or it's your line. Can you hear him okay, Karen?
A little. I mean, I can understand everything that we're discussing here, but there's maybe a little bit of a fuzziness on one of our lines here. But it's not preventing
okay,
me from,
I just wondered if it was just me.
From getting a gist here. Actually,
okay.
I wanted to, so,
and,
Todd, I wanted to ask you real quick. So having being a fan of Doctor Who, maybe the greatest time travel show of ever, right? And the most famous, and having played a time traveler on such a critically acclaimed show like 12 Monkeys, given the opportunity, would you travel in time? Do you think that's a good idea? And where would you go?
Would I travel
for when?
Mm-hmm.
I would absolutely travel through time if I knew it wasn't going to mess with the time stream. If I could be more of like a, you know, if it was like a Disneyland ride where you could just sort of witness things and taste the food without affecting the course of history, I would go back to turn of the century New York, and I would go to Coney Island.
Turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, 1800s.
Not turn of the 21st.
No, I would like the late 1800s. I would go to late Victorian. I'd go to Victorian New York or Victorian London.
Wow, really? What draws you to that period? I just watched that horrible serial killer show on TNT. Not a horrible show, but what was that show, Jamie? About the Alienist.
The Alienist.
I just watched The Alienist, and
I read those books.
It doesn't make me want to visit that time period, but what draws you to that time period?
I just find there's just, you know, I've spent time in Scotland and in the city of Edinburgh, which is very, feels very turn of the century. I just find it's just filled with intrigue and mystery and possibility. It's under the light bulb. And I think there's an innocence to it, as well as a darkness, you know, because it's Jack the Ripper time. It's Coney Island. It's the music is fantastic from that era. The clothing and the hairstyles were fantastic. I'm sure it stunk to high hell, but the cobblestones and the horse-drawn carriages and the gas lights, and it's just I've often been just intrigued. There's a great documentary by Rick Burns about Coney Island and the birth of Coney Island that I just am mesmerized by. And my improv show, The Doubtful Guest, all the characters are from 1888 London, but they've been killed in a brothel fire and they're forced to improvise a show as their damnation. And I love the theater of it all. I just saw The Greatest Showman, and I love it. And Moulin Rouge, and I just love that whole Belle Epoque era. Cine de Siecle, as they say.
Now, we have a question on Twitter. I guess they didn't want to call. They sent a question. I'm guessing this is just kind of what you would make up, because I don't think it's been in the show. But Cabin Boy wants to know what Deacon's little brother's name is, and what would be the name of your after bar.
God, I don't know. You know what? I think Terry. Now you have me on the spot. I think Terry has had a name. We talked about it, And I wrote up a big thing. It's been a while. And the name of the after bar, it would have to be the West 7, right?
Good.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it would have to be the West 7. I mean, I have a whole story that I have in my head of why I took out the West 7, and it all had to do with my brother. But, you know, I don't get to name the brother. That's Terry's job, because he created Deacon, and Deacon's he named, and oddly, Deacon, all three of Deacon's names are in Bill and Ted. So he's Theodore William Deacon. Deacon is Theodore William, and then Deacon is the name of one of them's little brother in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Cool. So
that's not a coincidence. Yeah, does Terry just love Bill and Ted?
I don't think it was intentional, Adley.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool, though.
Maybe it was subliminal, though.
It might have been subliminal. Ted Phillips as Robert Gale. Agent Jeff Gale, one of the writers of Preacher.
Do you have any more questions, Karen?
I mean, I could go on forever thinking of questions, but this has been a really great conversation. I guess I would ask you to, if we're nearing the end of our time together, whether or not we see Deacon again, what can fans expect from these last three episodes coming at us?
Last episode?
Two.
Technically, it's one episode over two. This is the popcorn one. This is the one that's like pedal to the metal, big summer blockbuster finale. Like, we're going out big, and that's what I think that is spectacular.
So you're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you could take like a step to the right and maybe we'd get better. I don't know if you're on a cell phone, but that's saying a lot. That's way better, actually. But you were saying pedal to the metal, spectacular finale, summer blockbuster, which is saying a lot for a show that is already... This show's already about the end of the world, so, like, how do we get bigger than that? Wow.
Now, how do you save it, right? I mean, like, if a movie was about, you know, Independence Day, about preventing the end of the world, it's like, okay, well, all the pieces are in place. Now we actually have to do the job, you know. The team splinter, they have to... they have to come together and make it happen. And I think it's one of those spectacular, satisfying, emotional, visually stunning endings. And I think people are going to be they're going to go, yeah, you stuck the landing. You guys did it.
Hmm.
And that is a testament to the writers. They really, I mean, and not just the writers, the Stephen Barton, our composer, and the editors, and this VFX in this season finale are just spectacular.
So you've seen it all. Did you guys watch it together, or did you watch it yourself?
I've not seen it all. I've seen parts of it because they were still working on the effects, and so Terry would send me clips. You have to see this sequence, you know, and we would share, he would share things with me. But I also read the script. So I know exactly how big the ending is. And no, we're not watching it all together. Amanda's in Toronto doing Suits. I'm in Vancouver doing Kim Possible. There's a bunch of people in Los Angeles. I think Emily is back doing Schitt's Creek. So we are all separated in different time zones and space.
Well, that's a little sad.
Very sad.
I would like to have been able
to watch it with everybody.
Jamie, are any of these guys tweeters? Do you expect any of the actors to be live tweeting or to be on social media as it airs? I know Jamie will be tweeting it as it airs.
Yeah, I think the actors are going to tweet.
Oh, it'll be fun. And it's a really good finale. I can say that. I'm just like thinking, what can I say without spoiling? That's why sometimes I get quiet. I'm like, it's good.
Also, Jamie's seen it.
Jamie's seen it
and Todd hasn't. That seems inherently unfair.
That actually happens a lot. You'd be surprised.
I've not sat down and watched it from opening credits to closing credits. But I have seen, I'm going to say, 80% of it. And a lot of, you know, because like I said, I got to see it. And I got to read them. So, you know, I mean, I read the finale. And it's
mm-hmm.
stunning.
Yep.
It's emotionally, I think it's really emotionally satisfying.
Oh, great. I got to tell you, as a fan, if I had to choose one, I prefer emotionally satisfying to maybe logically satisfying. I don't always have to have all the answers, as long as my characters get where they need to go. So I look forward to seeing that kind
of
finale. Oh, this podcast grew out of our Lost podcast. We started out with Lost, and I cry every time I watch that finale.
Where do you land at the end, the finale of Battlestar?
I have never watched Battlestar. Well, I watched the original when I was a little kid. I watched the original Battlestar, but I have not. I know I just lost all my genre cred.
I envy you because you get to now, there is a spectacular show that you've never seen out there waiting for you.
I know. I have something to live for. It's so great.
It's so good. And then the other show that's a buried treasure that I've been turning my friends on to was a one season series out of England called The Fades.
Oh, I love that. Although it didn't last very long. I think you've seen it, Karen. I think you don't remember the name. It was the one with they came back to life. I'm trying to think. It was a British show. I think you might have seen
very
it.
Much, it felt very Neil Gaiman. It was very, mm-hmm. very the actor from Get Out, and he's also in Black Panther. His name escapes me. He's in it.
I was sad at the end of that.
And then the guy that plays either Fitz or Simmons on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is the lead. And Natalie Dormer is in it as well.
Oh, great. Well, that's one for all of our listeners to check out if they haven't seen it.
Yeah, but so watch The Fades, and please, if you have not watched Battlestar, go back and do it. It's spectacular. Plus, there's a lot of 12 Monkeys actors that were two, at least, that were on Battlestar. Three. Allison was in Battlestar as well.
Oh, yeah?
Right.
Oh. God, Allison's only got to get on
live.
This podcast.
We can keep talking, but just so everybody knows, if you are listening to this, you can download the call in its entirety once we disconnect, because I think they lose it if they're – I can't remember if they're listening live. They might lose it, but there we go. But anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to say that. Do you have anything else that you want to add, Todd, or do you think people will want to know before we go?
I can't think of anything offhand other than, like I said, I really look forward to when, like, I can't wait to see people's reaction to the finale. I'm just very excited. Very excited.
Well, you'll get to see that soon enough. All right. Well, thank you for talking to us and for talking very long. I think we had a
You're
really
very
good conversation, so.
Well, you got me talking about things I love talking about. So, I can go all night talking about nerd stuff, so I'm happy to do it.
Okay, we'll have to come on again another time and talk. When something else comes up.
Thank you so much.
All right. Sure.
Right. Thanks on behalf of all our listeners. Yeah, thanks a lot, and good luck to you, and we look forward to your next gig, be it Suicide Squad or whatever else.
Indeed. Take care.
Thanks, you too.
Good night. Bye-bye. And I guess that wraps it up. So we will be back on Tuesday for a regular episode of Fandom Access. So have a good night, everybody.